Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
A Europe undivided and democratic must be a secure Europe. NATO is the bedrock of Europe's security and the tie that binds the United States to that security.
March 1997. President Bill Clinton met with Russian President Boris Yeltsin in Helsinki, Finland. The two men sat side by side, announcing agreement on a surprising array of security and economic issues. But there was one issue they could not put to rest: Clinton's support for the eastward expansion of NATO into former Soviet states. At the summit, Clinton turned to his left and looked directly at Yeltsin, a mere 2 feet away, as the Russian president said,
"We believe that the eastward expansion of NATO is a mistake, and a serious one at that."
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 25 years later, NATO is on the cusp of expansion yet again, this time into Sweden and Finland, the very nation where that 1997 summit was held. History is turning a circle here. Finland and Sweden seek NATO membership to protect them from Russian aggression following Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin holds, as he says here in December 2021, that it's NATO's previous expansion that in part justifies Russia's attack.
"We tried to stop this expansion. We were expressing our concerns. No, nothing. Go to hell with your concerns. We will do whatever we deem fit. Five waves of expansion. So what's this misunderstanding is about? Ask them, why can't they understand us? We want to ensure our security."
Well, we're going to spend 2 days looking at the story and consequences of NATO expansion in Europe. Tomorrow, we'll look at the alliance's present and future, how Finland and Sweden potentially joining NATO will change European security. Today, we're going to take a look at the past and the true story of the American domestic politics that contributed to that contentious moment in Helsinki in 1997. Well, Mary Elise Cerati joins us. She is a professor of the History of International Relations at Johns Hopkins University. She's also the author of Not One Inch: America, Russia, and the Making of Post-Cold War Stalemate. She possesses rare insight and documents about what led to Clinton's support for NATO expansion. Professor Cerati, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, and thanks for having me back.
First of all, I just want to ask you, when you think back and look back at that Helsinki summit in 1997, and especially that dynamic between Clinton and Yeltsin, the U.S. and Russia overall, in light of Putin's attack on Ukraine now, what do you see? What do you think about that 97 summit?
Well, it's important to say right up front that nothing from this history justifies what Putin is doing, as much as he would like to say that it does. Putin tends to cherry-pick history, so I'm glad that you're going to be devoting 2 days to this to help inform your listeners on some of the evidence that exists from various archives, including things I've gotten declassified from the Clinton Presidential Library. And when you look at the documents from that summit, it's clear this is when the bromance between Clinton and Yeltsin which had been quite robust, is clearly fading. It's clearly heading towards a tumultuous breakup. Clinton, in his own notes, noted that he and Yeltsin snarled at each other, used expletives with each other, and that it was really contentious, not least because, as one of his advisors put it, it was a summit of invalids because they had both recently suffered injuries. So this was a very ill-tempered summit, and it was a sign of what was to come in the future.
Okay. Well, what I'd like to do, first of all, is sort of set up some signposts on this strange arc between Russia and the United States between 1993 and 1997, because it begins with a plan that would eventually expand NATO, but also not exclude Russia. And that plan, as people might recall, was called the Partnership for Peace. So here's then Defense Secretary Les Aspin outlining the plan at a press conference in Washington in December of 1993.
It does not redivide Europe. We spent two generations trying to lift the Iron Curtain. We don't want to replace it by drawing another line. Partnership for Peace gives all nations the same chance to take part, but makes the results dependent on the effort of each partner.
Now, Secretary Aspin referred to the plan as, quote, a framework for a detailed operational military cooperation for multinational security efforts that has NATO at its core. But he clarified two key points that the partnership would not provide. One is that it would not provide a NATO security guarantee, Article 5, instantaneously to these key countries in Eastern Europe. And two, it would not automatically provide NATO membership.
Partners for Peace would not automatically become eligible for membership in NATO. In fact, somebody could join Partnership for Peace without even wanting to join NATO.
Secretary Aspin said that the plan gives Russia, quote, less heartburn than any other proposal that might add to NATO membership, and also gave Russia a seat at the table regarding NATO expansion. And a month later, President Bill Clinton brought that very proposal to the NATO summit in Brussels, and the alliance approved it.
Very pleased that our NATO allies approved our proposal for the Partnership for Peace. I believe it will help our alliance to meet Europe's new challenges, and I'm pleased by the response the partnership has already generated from nations who have contacted us and said they are interested in being a part of it.
Okay, recall that was 1993. But 4 years later, by the time of that Helsinki summit, Clinton had made a significant turn in foreign policy. He called on former Warsaw Pact and post-Soviet countries to fully join NATO, drawing a new line in Europe that both Clinton and Aspin had said 4 years earlier would not be drawn.
We are building a new NATO just as the Russian people are building a new Russia. I am determined that Russia will become a respected partner with NATO in making the future for all of Europe peaceful and secure. I reaffirm that NATO enlargement and the Madrid summit will proceed, and President Yeltsin made it clear that he thinks it's a mistake.
So, Professor Sarati, those are some moments from this four-year arc of history. But tell us about the genesis of the Partnership for Peace.
Sure. Kudos to your staff for pulling up those terrific clips. The Partnership for Peace was an answer to the question of how to enlarge NATO. And I think that's an important point to take away here from this history. NATO enlargement was not one thing. There were multiple possibilities for enlargement known at the time. And as Secretary of Defense Les Aspin said, the goal was to find the one that would give relatively less heartburn to Moscow. Now, the reason for that is not just altruism. The reason for that is that this time period that you're rightly focusing on, was not only an era of NATO enlargement, it was also the moment of the greatest cooperation, the greatest cooperation between Moscow and Washington ever in the field of reducing nuclear confrontation. They were engaged in a cooperative effort to basically dismantle or destroy former Soviet missiles pointed at America. And so the reason to not give heartburn to Moscow was to promote that process, which was unprecedented in nuclear history.
And this is where Ukraine is front and center already.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
Yeah. So when Ukraine became independent, and that happened in December 1991, And by the way, the 30th anniversary of that event is one of the reasons why Putin has taken action. He is particularly sensitive to anniversaries. Mm. Also the anniversary, the 30th anniversary of Soviet collapse. So if your listeners are wondering why now, why is Putin attacking Ukraine now, that's a big part of the answer. So when Ukraine became independent, because of the amount of Soviet arsenal on its territory, it was born nuclear. It was born the third biggest nuclear power in the world. And that attracts attention around the world. And that actually helped promote cooperation between Washington and Moscow because both wanted to denuclearize Ukraine. And they cooperated to try to basically get the portions of the arsenal on Ukrainian soil returned to Moscow. It's important to add that Moscow always had command and control because that's how it had been set up in the Soviet Union. But the Ukrainians were in physical possession of the weapons, and that was very worrying to Washington and Moscow. So Ukraine was a feature of this discussion very early on. And that then leads back to your question on the Partnership for Peace, because Clinton didn't want to leave Ukraine out in the cold. Mm. I was shocked in my research just how early on he realized that would be a problem. And he realized that it would be very hard to make Ukraine a NATO member, even though Tony Lake, his national security advisor, was in favor of it. And so he thought, you know, if we have this Partnership for Peace, this intermediate organization, as you heard in the clips, post-Soviet states like Russia and Ukraine can join, that will give them a berth in Europe, that'll help us to, you know, work with Ukraine and help promote its denuclearization.
So I want to just hold our focus for a second on the year before the Clinton administration comes in 1992. Yep. Because, I mean, it's when we say Washington said, your research reveals very specific people were divided in the administration of George H.W. Bush over what to do about the nuclear arsenal that Ukraine essentially inherited in the early 90s. And there was like this big divide between then Defense Secretary Dick Cheney and James Baker.
Yes, I was amazed when I discovered this in my research because the George H.W. Bush had excellent message discipline. They were very good at keeping internal disagreements internal. But as National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft revealed in an interview that was released only after his death, the Bush administration, and by this I mean the George H.W. Bush administration, was, in Scowcroft's words, badly split. And the split was exactly over this issue. The Soviet Union had been crumbling, of course, in 1991. It would finally collapse in December 1991. And as that was happening, on the one hand was Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, who thought this was the greatest thing ever. He thought Washington should do everything it could to break up the Soviet Union. That's a quote. I'm paraphrasing here, but for your listeners who are interested, the exact quotations are in my book, Not One Inch. So Cheney thought we should do everything possible, and he thought that a nuclear arsenal fractured among different states would actually be less dangerous. But Secretary of State James Baker disagreed vehemently, said that'll be Yugoslavia with nukes. We've got to work with Moscow to denuclearize this space, and he wins out by going to Bush and convincing Bush that he, Baker, is right.
Mm. I mean, you talk about how Baker went on all these urgent diplomatic missions to ensure that Russia emerged as the keeper of these nuclear weapons. But then George H.W. Bush loses the election and Bill Clinton comes into power. So we'll talk about what happens then right after the break. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today and tomorrow, we're taking a look at NATO expansion. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about its present and future. Today, we're focusing on NATO's expansion in the 1990s and the reverberation that has had across time all the way until now, especially given Russia's attack on Ukraine. I'm joined today by Mary Elise Sarati. She's a professor of history and of international relations at Johns Hopkins University and author of Not One Inch, America, Russia, and the Making of Post-Cold War Stalemate. Professor Sarati, stand by here for just a minute because I want to introduce Charles Kupchan into the conversation as well. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and professor of international affairs at Georgetown University. He was also director for European affairs on the National Security Council during the first Bill Clinton administration. Charles Kupchan, welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you and good to be with Mary.
And I note today that you're joining us from Delhi in India. So truly international.
That is correct.
International show. So yeah. Professor Kupchan, you've heard Professor Sarati sort of describe the run-up to Bill Clinton taking office in 1992, following the 1992 election. Can you tell us what your impression was of the president's, you know, view and opinion about Ukraine and NATO expansion at that time?
You know, I think the administration went through a great deal of debate. You know, and this is a debate that we will never resolve. Mary and I and everyone else who weighs in on NATO expansion will be debating this until the end of time, and we will never resolve the issue. Right? There are some who think it was a strategic mistake, others who think it was a great strategic coup, and this debate will continue. And that's the way it was in the Clinton administration. There was a strong group of people, myself included, who strongly supported the Partnership for Peace and did not believe that it was wise to proceed with formal NATO enlargement. And the Partnership for Peace effectively bought time. It was a way of kicking the can down the road. And there were two alternative ways it could unfold. One, that if everything went well, if Russia became a stable democracy, then NATO and the Partnership for Peace and this other pan-European organization called the Conference for Security and Cooperation Europe, they'd eventually merge and you'd have a pan-European collective security organization. The other alternative, the other outcome would be that Russia goes dark. Russia goes in a bad direction, and then Partnership for Peace becomes the gateway to formal NATO enlargement. Mm. That's kind of the way the debate was emerging until the later part of 1993. I think that Tony Lake was forward-leaning on the issue. The president was forward-leaning on the issue, more in my mind for ideological reasons than because of domestic pressure. You know, this was the end of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. This was our moment. It was time to universalize the liberal democratic order. And there were some key moments along the way. There was the Holocaust Museum opened in April of 1993. A very moving day. Elie Wiesel spoke. Václav Havel and Walesa were there, key figures from Czech Republic and Poland. They were saying to Clinton, bring us in, you know, get us on the right side of history. And then I would say the key point, as you've already discussed, was the NATO summit 94, which blessed the Partnership for Peace. But then in Prague, a few days later, Clinton said a key phrase. He said, "Its expansion is now not a question of whether, it's a question of when."
Yeah.
And that really changed the debate.
So hold on here for a second, because I want to turn back to Professor Sarati, because I think it's important for folks to understand, in addition to what Charles Kupchan is describing, sort of the way that the Clinton administration looked at the strategic sort of catch-22, if I can put it that way, a nuclear Ukraine, the dissolution of the former Soviet Union, and to Professor Kupchan's point, the end of the Cold War, what that presented. Because as you write, Professor Sarati, you say that Clinton wanted to find a way to make Ukraine feel secure enough to give up those nuclear weapons on its territory. But if he allowed the former Eastern Bloc countries to join NATO, that might have the opposite effect on Kyiv, that Kyiv would want to keep those nuclear weapons. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So in my book, I talk about the huge challenge facing Clinton, and I think that he did a good job with his huge challenge. The challenge was to respond to the post-Cold War interests of, on the one hand, as you rightly said, Ukraine, which is the third, to repeat, the third largest nuclear power in the world at this point, and then number two, a newly democratizing Russia. And then number three, the Central and Eastern Europeans, who wanted to join NATO. And I think they were fully justified in wanting to join NATO, and NATO was justified in taking them on. So he's got to square this circle, or as I say in my book, Not One Inch, he's got to square this triangle. But the good news is that unlike circles, triangles can be squared. And so I think the Partnership for Peace managed to square that triangle between the needs of Moscow, the needs of Kyiv, and the needs of Central and Eastern Europeans, because it provided a berth in a security structure in Europe for all of them. It did not leave Ukraine on the wrong side of an Article 5 line, and it allowed a certain amount of ambiguity, which was useful. Ooh. And that is, in fact, how Clinton sold the idea to Lech Walesa, the leader of Poland, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate. He initially hated the idea because he thought the Poles should have been in NATO yesterday. But Clinton said to him privately, he said, "You, the Poles, of all people, should understand what it means to be stuck on the wrong side of the line, and we don't want to leave Ukraine on the wrong side of the line." Mm. And so through clenched teeth, the Poles and Lech Walesa accepted it, and so the Partnership for Peace became policy, and I think it was a smart policy.
Well, so this is the point, that while, I keep hearing what Professor Kupchan was saying, echoing in my head, that it may not have been the sort of the ideologically preferred solution, but it was the one, Professor Sarati, as you point out, that was acceptable to all parties, minimally acceptable, as you put it, including to Russia, which is which is key here. But then, so this is the end of 1993, beginning of 1994 we're talking about. But then things happen later that year. So we have a moment here. This is from December 5th, 1994, where Ukraine signs the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, agreeing to become nuclear free. So here's President Bill Clinton right after the signing in Budapest.
Skeptics once claimed that the nuclear threat would actually grow after the Soviet Union dissolved. But because of the wisdom and statesmanship of the leaders who joined me here, the skeptics have been proven wrong.
So I want to hear from both of you on the impact of this Budapest memorandum. First to you, Charles Kupchan, what difference did it make?
You know, I don't think it had a huge difference on NATO enlargement at that time, because in many respects, the train had left the station. The key shifts were occurring over the course of 94. And Clinton really was under a lot of pressure from different sources. We've already talked about the appeals from Poland, from the Czech Republic. Kissinger and Brzezinski were very strong advocates of NATO enlargement. He was pushed, Clinton, by them. There was a lot of domestic pressure coming from the Polish community, the American Czech community. There were domestic political reasons to proceed with formal enlargement. And the Republicans in particular were hitting at Clinton for not moving quickly enough on this issue. And then I think there were lots of changes going on inside, orchestrated in part by Tony Lake, who was very pro-expansion, bringing into key positions a set of individuals that helped not just move the policy from Partnership for Peace to NATO enlargement, but also to implement it. And that was key. It was key not just to say it's no longer a question of whether, but when, to actually turn it into policy. Uh-huh. And that crank began to turn over the course of 94.
So, but Professor Sarati, I wonder, though, if concern over nuclear weapons in Ukraine was initially a major driving force here. When that concern goes away, where does that leave both Ukraine and the Partnership for Peace?
Right. So this is a factor in why the story shifts. Two quick remarks. The Partnership for Peace was not a scam. And I say that because that's how Russia saw it afterwards. In other words, Moscow later said, oh, you just proposed this Partnership for Peace to deceive us and to provide cover for yourself as you actually started handing out Article 5 to Central and Eastern European countries. That is how what Russia says now. That is not what I see in the evidence. I see in the evidence that the Partnership for Peace was a serious attempt to, as I said, square the circle and define places in Europe for not only Central and Eastern Europeans, but also Ukraine and Russia. But then what happens subsequently, as you've rightly pointed out, is that there's a bunch of domestic politics that come into play. And those, by the way, are domestic politics not just in the United States, but also in Russia. Mm-hmm. And because of those domestic politics, which I think we're going to get into, that starts to erode the support for the Partnership for Peace and starts to increase the likelihood that you're going to move towards formal Article 5 expansion, where countries are either all in or all out. There's nothing in between. There's no intermediate. Organization.
Well, I want to talk more, though, about what happened in Budapest in December of 1994, because we just heard President Bill Clinton talking about the reducing, in his words, the nuclear threat, because Ukraine was willing to give up the arms on its territory. But at the same conference, and I believe on exactly the same day, Boris Yeltsin angrily calls out the United States for trying to, quote, split the continent again through NATO expansion. So listen along with us, because here's Yeltsin speaking through an interpreter.
NATO was created in the time of the Cold War. Today, not without difficulty, it is seeking its place in the new Europe. It's important that this quest should not give rise to new zones of demarcation, but should rather consolidate European unity. This logic, in our view, is contradicted by NATO's plans for expansion. Why sow the seeds of mistrust? After all, we are no longer enemies. We are all partners now. We hear explanations to the effect that this is allegedly the expansion of stability, just in case there are undesirable developments in Russia. If, on those grounds, the intention is to move the frontiers of NATO's responsibility up to Russia's borders, then let me say one thing. It's too soon to bury democracy in Russia. We must not repeat the mistakes of the past. No major country is going to live by the laws of isolation, and any such country will reject such a game played with it.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin in Budapest in 1994. Professor Sarati, what is going on here?
Yeah, that's a great quote. Again, kudos to your staff for pulling up great clips. So a little bit of background to explain what's going on there. As we discussed, the Partnership for Peace comes into being. I think it's a workable solution. But in December 1994, just shortly before the Budapest summit, supporters of a more assertive NATO enlargement, giving Article 5 the all or nothing, the guarantee that you will treat an attack on yourself as an attack on all, they start to make headway, and they get a line inserted into a NATO communique earlier in December 1994, indicating that the extension of Article 5 is going to happen sooner rather than later. Again, I'm paraphrasing, mm-hmm. but the exact events are in my book, Not One Inch. And when Yeltsin learns about that, and that's just before the summit that we just heard, Yeltsin is furious. He says, oh, this Partnership for Peace, that was actually just a scam. This is what they really want to do. And he decides to vent that anger at that summit. And that is a bracing moment when the cold winds of the Cold War blow again. President Clinton is blindsided by this. On the plane on the way back, he angrily turns to his staff and says, how could you drag me all the way across the ocean just to be used as a punching bag by Yeltsin? Where did that come from? But this is Yeltsin's sense that Moscow is being betrayed by the way Washington is enlarging NATO. He felt that he had agreed to the partnership, Russia was joining the partnership, and all of a sudden it seems like to Yeltsin it's bait and switch at a time when he's having serious domestic problems. The key phrase there is it's too soon to bury democracy in Russia.
Now, Professor Kupchin, I know we only have you for a few more minutes here. So first of all, I'd love to get your response to what Professor Sarati said. And then before we have to let you go, also get your thoughts on, you know, what are the relevant parts of this history that sort of help us understand the import and impact of NATO's potential expansion into Finland and Sweden now?
Yeah. Well, I agree with Mary that the relationship started to deteriorate, in part because of domestic political forces on both sides, in part because the Russian economy was collapsing. Russia carried out some pretty harsh policies in Chechnya, which reinforced those on the U.S. side who were saying, hey, we can't trust Russia. Time to get NATO's border moving to the east. But, you know, Yeltsin was telling Mr. Clinton well before that clip, don't do this. There are private conversations that took place in 93 where he said, you know, you move this line further east, you will isolate us and we will respond somehow in kind. And so there really was a difference of opinion here. And the Partnership for Peace, I think, was everything for everybody. And everyone took away from it what they wanted to. You know, my particular view was that it in some ways kicked the can down the road. Some of my colleagues who were pro-NATO expansion understood it to be the beginning of the expansion process. And I think Yeltsin was similarly confused. And that's because there was ambiguity in the policy, which I think Mary has drawn out. The other point I'd make here, and this is why I think the expansion of NATO that began in 94 and into 95 is so complicated, is that it's hard to stop, right? Once you bring in the first tranche of members, then the others that are nearby were saying, well, wait a minute, what about us? Why are we on the wrong side of this dividing line? And so you bring the next wave in, and then the others are saying, well, what about us? And so that's why there have been these successive waves of NATO enlargement, getting to the point in 2008 where NATO says, okay, Georgia and Ukraine are on the track to NATO membership. And that really set up where we are today. Mm. That is to say, this fundamental disconnect between Russia and the United States over Ukraine and its geopolitical future.
Well, Charles Kupchin, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and professor of international affairs at Georgetown, also formerly director of European affairs on the NSC during the first administration of Bill Clinton. Professor Kupchin, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Professor Mary Elise Sarati, hang on here for just a second, because there's a lot more of what happened in 1994, 1995, and 1996 that I want to talk with you about. So we'll do that in a second. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I just want to make a note of a show we're working on for next week. The United States is approaching a milestone, 1 million dead from COVID-19. So we want to hear from you if you've lost a family member, a friend, a loved one, anyone close to you to COVID. Call us and tell us about them. Who were they? What did they mean to you? How do you want to remember them? How do you want the world to remember the person that you lost to COVID. Call us with their stories. We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We're working on that for next week. Today, we're talking about a critical period in 20th century history, and that is roughly between 1993 and 1997, in a period of NATO expansion, and how that relates to the devastating attack Russia has perpetrated on Ukraine now. And I'm joined today by Mary Elise Sorati. She's professor of the history of international relations at Johns Hopkins University and author of the terrific book, Not One Inch, America, Russia, and the Making of Post-Cold War Stalemate. And Professor Sorati also was able to get fascinating documents declassified from the Clinton administration. And Professor, I'd actually just like to talk with you about one of them before we move forward into what happened in 1994, because we had mentioned Budapest and Yeltsin's outburst at Budapest. But I'm looking at one of the documents you got declassified here, and I think it's from Yeltsin to Clinton, where Yeltsin writes in this memo that they, prior to Budapest, had discussed that, quote, "We have agreed with you that there would be no surprises, that we should first pass through this stage of partnership, whereas issues of further NATO expansion would not be decided." And then he says, if that happens, that it'll be interpreted, and not only by Russia, as the beginning of a new split in Europe. Am I reading that right?
Yes. So this question of was NATO going to enlarge, and if so, how far, that question actually had been around since, frankly, the Berlin Wall had come down in 1989. Because when the Berlin Wall came down, when it collapsed, so too did the Cold War order. And with the Cold War order collapsing, the question was, you know, what happens next, right? So this question had been around for a while, and Yeltsin had consistently said, as he said in that letter, you know, it'll be better if we don't have any surprises. The problem then is that there was a couple of problems, but one of the problems is that Yeltsin, as we discussed with Budapest, is then surprised when, after agreeing to the Partnership for Peace, suddenly the advocates of a more formal expansion, giving Article 5 out, start to make headway. And by the way, it's not only Yeltsin who's surprised, it's also the Pentagon in the United States. The Secretary of Defense Les Aspin and then Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, his successor, were very strong supporters of the Partnership for Peace because it kept relations with Moscow stable and enabled them to make progress on destroying parts of the Soviet nuclear arsenal that were pointed at the United States. Their argument was, you know, we understand the Central and Eastern Europeans wanted to be in NATO yesterday, but, you know, we're the Defense Department of the United States, and we're currently making the United States a lot safer with our cooperation with Moscow to destroy nuclear weapons. So they wanted to continue on this course. But then, of course, the people who are in favor of a more assertive mode of expansion, less ambiguity, they start to move forward. And that surprises not only the Pentagon, but also Yeltsin. And
okay.
Then that leads to the quote you had is why he is then so angry in Budapest, because
Understood.
He feels surprised.
Okay. So, you know, Boris Yeltsin may have felt surprised. That seems pretty well established now. But so Budapest was on December 5th, 1994.
Yes.
But Yeltsin also does something that essentially sort of puts the steel in the rods of more hawkish people in Europe and the United States. And he does it just 6 days later, on December 11th, 1994. He orders Russian forces to enter Chechnya, right? So an act of Russian aggression that NATO, in a sense, exists in order to protect against, of course, not Chechnya in particular, but Russian aggression overall. So, of course, this gets NATO's attention. Several months later, then German Chancellor Helmut Kohl was in Washington meeting with President Clinton. And here's what Clinton said on that day.
Recent events in Russia were an important part of our discussions today, especially the tragedy in Chechnya. Chancellor Kohl and I are in full agreement. The violence there must end and negotiation must begin. Every day the fighting continues, more innocent civilians fall victim. In our conversations with President Yeltsin, we have both made clear our fears about the corrosive effect the conflict in Chechnya can have on democratic, market-oriented reform in the Russian Republic. But the conflict has not changed the nature of our interests, namely that Russia's efforts to become a stable democratic nation must succeed.
So, Professor Sarati, Ukraine has given up the nukes that were on its territory. Then Russia sends tanks into Chechnya. How much of this sort of dooms the Partnership for Peace?
Yeah, so at first, Ukraine said it would give up the weapons. It took a couple of years until it actually happened.
Yeah.
But it was clear what was going to happen. Yeah, these are key events, and this circles back to what you said at the top of the hour about the role of domestic politics. So two things are important to note. Number one, there is agency on both sides, right? This is not simply a story of, you know, what went wrong in Washington. A lot went wrong in Moscow. And number two, that's a lot driven by domestic politics. And what you've just described, going into Chechnya, was a key part of the crumbling of democratic reform in Russia, as the then Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozyrov said, Chechnya was a bad mistake. In other words, Yeltsin decides, and he does this already in late 1993 as well, he decides to use violence against his political opponents rather than keeping confrontations on a nonviolent level. Now, to be fair, his opponents, some of them are basically fascists, but he decides nonetheless to move to the plane of violence, which you don't want democracies to do. So in October 1993, Yeltsin has tanks fire on his own parliament. And so that's the first time he's shedding the blood of his political opponents. But what you've just described, December 1994, when he goes into Chechnya, which turns into a truly gruesome conflict that sadly foreshadows what's happening in Mariupol, that's when the Central and Eastern Europeans say, wait a minute, this new Moscow is just like the old Moscow, invading people. We can't just have this compromise, the Partnership for Peace, anymore. We can't live with this ambiguity of what it means for our membership. We need Article 5. We need that guarantee that an attack on one will be treated as an attack on all. And it became very hard in the West to argue against that. And so this obviously makes Partnership for Peace much less tenable.
Okay. So that's what's happening in Russia. So let's take our focus back to domestically here in the United States. I mean, looking back at the history now, it's a very tumultuous time because
yes.
because we're approaching we've passed the 1994 midterm elections in this history that we're going through, and then we're approaching the 1996 elections here. And yes. I see again in one of the documents that you got declassified that there looks like there's a member of the Clinton administration who's communicating with the Russians, I believe, who says that they have seen the Clinton administration has just reviewed a copy of the Republican drafted National Security Act of 1995, which would be introduced in Congress in the what the GOP called the Contract with America. Now, what's interesting in this memo is that it says, although a number of the draft's act's previous provisions are relatively unexceptional, there are some which would be controversial with a number of European partners, including facilitating the transition of other European countries, in particular the Baltic states and Ukraine, towards full NATO membership. So talk about that.
Yeah, so there's obviously a bunch of factors that combine to shift the NATO expansion strategy to one of giving out Article 5. Again, important to remember, there were multiple ways of enlarging NATO. NATO enlargement was not one thing. And so you've rightly identified the key factors in this shift. You've got first, you have Clinton coming into office, then you have the creation of the policy of the Partnership for Peace, which I think had useful ambiguity attached to it and also provided a berth for Russia and Ukraine. But because of primarily three factors, the Russian invasion of Chechnya, the fact that Ukraine denuclearizes, and so taking care of Ukraine becomes less important, and then finally what you've just described, the contract with America, and the more importantly, the Republican victory in the midterm congressional elections of November 1994, all of that helps to doom the Partnership for Peace. I should say that the partnership still exists, but it ceases to be the primary vehicle for NATO enlargement. Clinton has to pay attention to the success of the Republicans because he wants to be reelected in 1996. And he needs exactly those voters with whom the Republicans are doing well in November 1994, such as American citizens of Central and Eastern European origin in the Midwest, which, by the way, includes my relatives. he's looking at all these things, President Clinton, and he's hearing people like his National Security Advisor, Tony Lake, and others saying, you know, we don't need this ambiguity. We really should be, these countries have waited too long for Article 5. They've suffered too much. And his Russia advisor, Strobe Talbot, in particular, by 95, is saying, you know, we really should keep going with NATO enlargement. It won't be complete until it gets to the Baltics.
Yeah. So just to describe the intensity of the politics on the domestic front on this and the fact that the Republican Party at the time sensed a weakness in the Clinton reelection campaign. I mean, here's how Republican Senator Mitch McConnell talked about it on April 19th, 1996.
For most Americans, the issue is not whether we have a relationship with Russia, but what kind of relationship, with what kind of leader, and on whose terms. For 3 years, we've seen policy driven by personality. We've experienced 3 years of American interest taking a back seat to a reckless Boris Yeltsin behind the wheel. The administration's policy has America on a crash course. The president's reluctance to decisively advance an American agenda, his reservations about clearly promoting U.S. interests, have only tempted the Russian nationalist bear out of political hibernation. The administration's failure to condemn the outrageous assault on Chechnya civilians has made a mockery of our 207-year history of faithful service to the Bill of Rights. Yielding to Russian sensitivities, the president's failure to spell out an explicit timetable in terms for prompt NATO expansion risks the hard-won freedom of our Central European and Baltic allies and our long-term interests in stabilizing Europe.
Senator Mitch McConnell, April 19, 1996. So the 96 election happens. Clinton essentially gets on the NATO expansion bandwagon quite fully, and that takes us back to the beginning of this program, where the Helsinki summit happens, and Clinton clearly expresses a support for NATO expansion. And what, by the middle of 97, NATO invites Hungary, Poland, and the Czech Republic to join the alliance. So, Professor Sarati, we've got about 4 minutes left here. I would love to hear from you, now that we've gone through this fascinating history, what is it important for us to understand now regarding how Vladimir Putin looks at this same history and how you think it might have impact or inform what we should consider as Finland and Sweden seek NATO membership?
Sure. Let me just preface an answer to your question by saying it's important to remember that there are domestic politics both in Washington and in Russia. Obviously, here we're focusing on the United States and on Clinton, but there's also domestic political missteps by Yeltsin as well. Corruption rises in Russia on his watch, and the democratic reform unravel. So it's really a story of the interaction. There's agency on both sides. And I mentioned that as preface to talking about legacy for today. So for the current president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, what we've been talking about it isn't just in living memory. This is lived memory for him. He was, of course, in divided Germany in 1989 as a junior KGB officer. He witnessed the collapse of Soviet power firsthand, and this is a searing memory for him. And he argued at the time that Moscow should use violence. He actually wanted to shoot peaceful protesters who came to the KGB outpost, and he called Soviet forces for reinforcement. And the person who answered the phone said, "I'm not going to do that without explicit authorization from Moscow, and Moscow is silent." Moscow is silent. And Putin has said consistently that that was a huge mistake, and certainly Moscow is not silent today. And so Putin remembers these things and has a grievance about how the post-Cold War order left Russia in the lurch. Now, of course, this doesn't justify the brutality he is showing in Ukraine, and I have to express my admiration for the people who are fighting there. But he does spin this narrative based on these grievances that emerged. And then in particular, concerning 1997, which is, as you said, just 25 years ago this year, he has this mistaken sense that somehow in 1997, Russia should have had a veto over NATO's ability to give Article 5 to Central and Eastern European countries. In part, this is because Boris Yeltsin, out of frustration in 97, simply started saying in public that he, Boris Yeltsin, had gotten a veto. This was not accurate, but he started saying it to assuage his domestic opponents. And that created this popular sense that in 1997, Russia got a veto, which somehow the West is now violating. Again, to emphasize, that didn't happen. And American diplomats at the time were writing behind the scenes to Yeltsin's aides saying, why is Yeltsin saying this? This isn't true. And his aides, the Russian aides responded to Americans, we're trying to tell him this, but he just won't understand.
Right.
You have to remember that Yeltsin was a man with a very serious drinking problem and a man who was suffering from severe heart disease and was simply absent much of the time because of illnesses.
So can I just jump in here? Because we only have about 30 seconds left.
Sure.
So, I mean, one of the conclusions that I draw from your considerable scholarship here is that you believe NATO expansion was justified. It just happened in the wrong way. So is it happening in the wrong way again now with potentially Finland and Sweden?
Well, now we're in an entirely different context. Cold wars are not short-lived affairs, so thaws are precious. And the 1990s were a thaw. And what we did and what Russia did in that era carried outsized importance. And so that's why the fact that there were all these misunderstandings over how NATO was expanding that created friction and scar tissue, that's why that's so important. Now we're on a war footing, and now if Sweden and Finland want to join NATO, then I think that would be a positive development in light of the horrors currently unfolding in Ukraine.
Well, Mary Louise Cerotti, the book is Not One Inch, America, Russia, and the Making of Post-Cold War Stalemate. Thank you so much for coming back on the show today, Professor Cerotti.
Thank you so much for your attention to these important issues.
And again, tomorrow we'll be talking more about Finland and Sweden and NATO. This is On Point.